Supreme Court of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice is presiding.
Good morning and be seated. Our first case this morning on the docket is case number 58533. This is D.R. Horton versus the District Court, otherwise known as High Noon at Arlington. Mr. Carlson, Mr. Terry, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Very well. Mr. Carlson.
May it please the Court. Your Honor, first off, we'd like to reserve, I think, 4 minutes at the end for any rebuttal, if I may. The issues that are presented in this phase of the argument is whether or not the court had an obligation to conduct, the trial court had an obligation to conduct a Rule 23 analysis concerning the standing rights of the HOA. And this case, I think, presents a relatively unique situation in that it's the subject of a prior order of this court, wherein the trial court was ordered to conduct such an investigation and analysis and did not do so. In fairness to the trial court conducted an analysis on under Rule 23 of the allegations on the interior of the units, but determined, contrary to this court's ruling, contrary to this court's holding in First Light 2, that no analysis was necessary, no Rule 23 compliance was necessary on the building envelope. The issue there, of course, is that the building envelope does not have any special rights or even a definition in law, state of Nevada, nor is it defined in the CC&Rs, nor is it defined anywhere that we could find in the jurisprudence of this state or others. So the obligation to not do an analysis in that seems to be not founded upon either the facts or the law. This court ordered an analysis. The trial court chose not to do it on the basis of stare decisis and also the fact that this court has a right to control the actions of the trial courts. It would appear that that was a rejection of this court's order without any reasonable justification. The court seemed to indicate that she thought that the building envelope had a special standing, I guess. Well, it's not really a very good word for it, in light of construction defects. And the argument made by the Homeowners Association was that in a typical condominium association case, the association has the right and obligation to maintain the exterior surfaces, and therefore they share the right and obligation to sue in this case, or at least the right. In this case, however, as the court noted previously in this very action, the definition of who is obligated to maintain the building envelope is rest solely with the unit owners and not with the association at all. The situation we're faced with is that the association would like to have standing. They had no standing either on the basis of the CC&Rs, and therefore they tried to go to 116. Well, this court has interpreted 116 as requiring them to satisfy the Rule 23 analysis. But then the trial court determines that, no, they don't have to do that. And so we're kind of put in an awkward position because although we have great respect for the trial court, we believe that she was in error in her decision not to do what this court specifically ordered. And we really can't reconcile that with the analysis that this court provided in First Life and also the obligation of the trial court to follow the directives of this court. As a result of that, we felt obligated to bring a petition and ask the court, I guess, to reorder the trial court to make the determination that, in fact, the Homeowners Association has standing for these building envelope issues must satisfy Rule 23, including all the requirements. Now, there was an argument made by the Homeowners Association that the analysis required by this court in First Light is a direct contravention to the standing conferred by the legislature, even though this court found that there was standing conferred by the legislature. It appeared that the main argument focused on whether the numerosity requirement of the Rule 23 analysis could be satisfied in light of the legislative language of the right of the association to bring an action on behalf of itself or in two or more of the unit owners. This court, I believe, has at least commented, though not in writing, on that issue, that numerosity may be satisfied by the requirements set forth in the legislative mandate. As a result of that, we're not going to argue that numerosity wasn't satisfied in this case. However, the remainder of the issues, if the trial court had done an analysis of the building envelope, would not be satisfied. And I think the issue that the court is facing is this, is that...
Well, that may be a little speculative, yet the court didn't do a Rule 23 analysis as directed with respect to its representative capacity. Could you clarify and ask your opponent to do the same? I'm a bit confused by the judge's order on page 20 as to what is permitted and what is not permitted. In the order, the judge indicates that the association can proceed with respect to constructional defects that may affect the 114 triplex building envelopes or exterior walls, wall openings, and roofs. But then the last sentence appears to exempt from that right claims for fire-resistant plumbing electrical systems found within the interior or exterior walls. Is that your understanding of the order?
That is my understanding of the order. The resistive fire-resistive walls that the trial court's referring to, Your Honor, I believe is resistive walls between the individual units and not the exterior. They don't reach the building envelope. They're really an interior section. The units are divided in an interesting fashion in that there's a front unit which encompasses the entire cross-section of the building, and there are two side-by-side units behind that. Both have a front on opposite ends of the building. As a result of that, there's fire-resistive walls in the center of the building and in between the two rear units. They don't reach the exterior portion of the wall, and I assume that that's what the court's referring to when she says that the fire-resistive issues are not within the do not count as far as the exterior walls. So I'm not sure that her order in that way is inconsistent with her previous paragraph, which says that they can pursue the building envelope.
Well, let's assume for the moment, maybe I'll just stick with roofs since the walls portion of this seems a bit confusing to me about what the judge had said, because on the previous page in paragraph 35 at lines 16 through 18, in remarking about the fact that the statute was somehow nullified, the judge makes the point that conducting a Rule 23 analysis on behalf of the members, the constructional defects affecting the common interest community, such as those upon or within exterior walls, would nullify the statute. If you follow that reasoning, one would assume then that plumbing and electrical systems within the exterior walls would be the subject of a claim that the association could make. So it's unclear to me how the judge arrives at the conclusion she arrived at, given the rationale used on the prior page. But my question really deals, let's take roofs, for example. And I was going to ask your opponent to clarify where in paragraph 16 of the complaint the defects relating to roofs is articulated. But had the judge conducted a Rule 23 analysis on commonality, typicality, and predominance with respect to the roofs, could the judge have arrived at a conclusion that the association could proceed with constructional defects on the roofs?
The difficulty we're facing with, Your Honor, is that There's numerous allegations made, which are generalized in nature in the reports generated by the plaintiff's experts, in that they talk about percentages. They don't follow the SHUTI requirement, which is that the individual unit must be identified, the individual defect must be identified, and the resultant repair must be identified. So as a result of that, I don't believe that the trial court, even if inclined to do that analysis, would have been able to conclude that the Rule 23 requirements have been met, because there is insufficient data presented to the trial court in the underlying action.
Well, let's stick with roofs. What was the extrapolation evidence with respect to the defects in the roofs presented to the trial court?
There was a percentage amount provided to the trial court on the basis of what the plaintiffs indicate is a representative action. And I don't have right at my fingertips the percentage amount, but we'll look it up. But rather than identify which individual unit had a roofing defect and what that defect was and whether that defect had caused damage, what was presented was that we looked at X number of roofs, and of that X number of roofs, this many had a, quote, defect, and therefore we believe that it could be extrapolated on.
You mean the defect itself wasn't articulated in the extrapolation reports?
There were several that were conglomerated together into a single defect. So in one case, there was failure to have adequate flashing. Another was a failure to have, had tiles that were exposed. There was also some units that had differing types of alleged defects, but not a...
So as the judge articulated in her order, there was a myriad of defects affecting the roofs. Is that what you're saying?
I would agree, Your Honor. As the court in its order, this is the data that we're familiar with. The expert broke down the roofing defects into two groups depending on the elevation of the building. 10 subcategories and then 60 more subcategories for both elevations. And then they inspected 46% of the decks and invasively tested 10% of the decks. The decks also act as a roof for purposes of the building envelope. They then had 4 subcategories for defects which were invasively tested. As a result of that, they didn't identify specifically what the defects were other than in a subcategory, and then said they applied on a percentage basis. So instead of saying, for example, unit 132 had this problem, what we have is basically a percentage analysis presented to us.
Well, is there anything wrong with the district court judge conducting a predominance and typicality analysis relying on the expert report, one identifies 10 units with flashing after invasive inspection, and if they're assuming all the roofs contain the same type of construction for that flashing, arguing that there is predominance and typicality for associational representation suits for constructional defect for the flashing defect in all those units.
I don't believe there's anything wrong with arguing that. The fact of the matter is that typically those claims vary substantially, even though they're described as a flashing defect, because as we've argued before this court, and I think several other people have said, these are handmade units. And so the fact that one unit has a lack of mastic under...
Well, you're arguing that under the facts of the case and the units and the construction type, that analysis couldn't be made. But I'm,
yes,
hypothetically, if the construction was in the manner I described and consistent with my question, couldn't the judge arrive at the conclusion that 23 applies and predominance and typicality and commonality are satisfied?
Yes, the court, if the trial court was presented with sufficient evidence that there was a common defect that could be solved and presented by common evidence, yes, she could conclude that a Rule 23 analysis had...
And the judge could conclude that using extrapolation evidence if it was supported by appropriate engineering or architectural studies.
And statistical analysis, I would have to agree with the court.
All right.
I see I'm beyond my time, though.
Mr. Carlson, I'm going to give you an additional 2 minutes simply because there's been a myriad of questions, so please consider yourself to have an additional 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I will reserve that to my response.
Very well.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Terry.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justices of the Court. My name is Paul Terry, and I represent the Honeymet Arlington Ranch Homeowners Association. I, too, would like to reserve a few minutes for a rebuttal. When we look at this case, we have to start with what exactly it is that we're dealing with. At High Noon, we have 342 units. They're in 114 identical two-story buildings with three units in each building. There's nothing that's unique about these buildings. They are all identical. There is, however, something of an anomaly regarding these buildings. Although one of the three units is constructed on top of portions of the other two units, the CC&Rs and the plat map label the units townhouses and define the boundaries of the units in what I would characterize as a tortured manner reminiscent of a gerrymandered political map. It doesn't really make any sense other than for perhaps the purposes of litigation.
Mr. Terry, did your complaint articulate any other defects or articulate defects other than those identified in paragraph 16 of the complaint?
Your Honor, I did not bring a copy of the complaint with me, and it was not a complaint that, my office drafted. I took over litigation about halfway through, and so I'm afraid
okay.
I can't answer your question directly.
Okay. In the motion practice, did the plaintiff articulate the nature of the complaints that it was raising, let's just say, with respect to the roofs?
Your Honor, I believe it did. The motion practice included as part of the moving papers copies of all of the expert reports which detailed which defects were discovered, where they were discovered, and I think included the photographs as well.
So other than the reports that were presented, no other defects were articulated?
That is correct.
Okay. Could you take the roof as an example? Your opponent has argued that the judge didn't do as the Supreme Court directed with respect to articulating or conducting a Rule 23 analysis. Let's just take the roofs, for example. It does appear the court decided not to for her view of the statute, but had such an analysis been done, what would the analysis have been on commonality and typicality for the roofs?
Well, Your Honor, it's a great question, and I think you have to start with the language of the statute, which grants the association authority to bring the claim as long as there's a condition that affects two or more owners. And so as we look through the defects, as long as you have a defect that is common to at least two of the owners, then the association has standing. Whether or not the defect occurs often enough that it can be extrapolated throughout the project is really a different issue. It's an evidentiary issue regarding the role of extrapolation and whether or not its requirements have been met. But with respect to any particular defect, under NRS 116, as long as the same condition exists in at least two units, then I believe the association has standing under an analysis. Whether that's a strict Rule 23 analysis is much harder to say because I don't believe, as the judge pointed out, Rule 23 can really be reconciled on a specific basis with the mandate set out in NRS 116-3102-1D.
Well, Counsel. Excuse me. Go ahead, Judge.
I've been listening to the use of the word standing. 116 merely gets you into court. The question is how you're going to conduct the trial. There are a myriad of ways to do so. So why does not 23 requirements stand up and have to be fulfilled as one of the options opposed to pursuing it pursuant to, say, 42, a consolidation of separate trials on each individual property, so to speak?
Well, Your Honor, I think if you go through the different elements of Rule 23 analysis, and not simply just the numerosity ones, Rule 23 doesn't really match up with what would be required given the grant of standing in NRS 116.
Well, 116, when you start looking at it, it really talks about coming into court and in a particular way, and it doesn't really express how you're going to conduct the trial, which 23 is a more specific element in terms of conducting a trial or trials. So I guess I'm sitting here and I'm looking at this, and 23 allows you to do certain things you can't do in other actions within the court once you're in court. So why should that not be met, that requirement?
Well, I guess to begin with, I would especially disagree with the court that Rule 23 directs how the trial itself is conducted. I believe it's more of whether or not you can get into the courtroom and make those claims. One of the points that I wish to make is that I think a number of the issues that were identified as problems in the Schutte case are legitimate problems and ought to be resolved in some manner.
116.3102.1d, institute, defend, or intervene in litigation or administrative proceedings in its own name on behalf of itself or two or more unit owners on matters affecting the common interest community. That's what D says. So that gets you in the door. Then the question is, how do you proceed?
Well, again, I think that since the statute itself says...
Can you point me to some place in the statute that says what you're asserting it says?
The statute says that the association has standing if there's a condition that affects two or more owners. So if there's just two...
Standing to come into court? Standing to proceed with trial? What standing does it have?
I believe that it has standing to come into court and present its evidence. I think the issue that the court is raising, and it's a legitimate one, is an issue of extrapolation. To the extent that the condition affects two or more owners, the association is entitled to bring that claim and present evidence that those particular two owners have the condition. The problem, I think, that arises is that if you have a project, let's say, like High Noon, where you have 342 units and you have a condition which affects at least two, the question is how far beyond those two ought the trial court to allow further evidence or argument for damages to be made. And I think that issue is much better handled by the trial court with appropriate direction from the Supreme Court, of course, at the evidentiary stage when the case is being presented. In other words, do you have enough evidence to bring that claim regarding more than just the specific owners that you have identified, or can you extrapolate that beyond those?
But that then, doesn't it take us into a 23 analysis?
I believe it takes us into an analysis that is somewhat akin to Rule 23, and I think that a set of guidelines could be fashioned by this court that more narrowly tailors the concepts in Rule 23 to the context of a homeowners association.
So are you asking us to create a new rule today?
I'm asking you to narrow, yes, the Rule 23 analysis to reflect the fact that the legislature has already determined, as an example, that the homeowners association is, in fact, an appropriate class representative, even though it may of itself not have any claims, that it's entitled to be able to bring those issues. And so I think you have to, for example, really toss out numerosity as one of the elements. You need to toss out whether or not the association is an appropriate class representative, because again, the legislature has already made those determinations.
You keep using the word class, but it says it can institute, defend, or intervene in litigation or administrative proceedings in its own name or on behalf of itself or two or more unit owners. It does not use the term class at all.
Well, I agree, Your Honor, and I think that's really the point. The association has a right to bring those claims, and what we are trying to do now is really looking to the commentary and the restatement of property and say, okay, how are we going to apply class action principles to a homeowners association where the legislature really has already made a determination that it is an appropriate entity to bring the claim.
Mr. Chair,
excuse
me. Go ahead,
How about you just use Class 23 analysis, which appears to be, in my mind, the appropriate way to proceed. In fact, what I hear you suggesting in response to Justice Douglas's question is that we should carve out a special exception for a class action-like concept in or under or as a result of what Chapter 116 already starts. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
I think that's correct. I think we need to look at what it is that the legislature has already given us, which is that as long as there are two or more owners affected, then the association has standing to bring that claim.
Why aren't you arguing that we shouldn't intervene at this time, then? It sounds like if you go with what Justice Douglas says about standing, that you've got the standing, and why should this court intervene at this time when you've got all kinds of evidentiary hearings that you can have in the district court and give us findings so that we can make an appropriate decision on appeal after, depending on who wins or loses?
Well,
Chair, I'm going to interrupt procedurally for a moment on that question, simply because you indicated you were going to reserve rebuttal time. It's a writ proceeding. You don't get rebuttal. You got the rest of your time to proceed.
Thank you, Chair. I think the answer is that we need better direction from the Supreme Court because Rule 23 in its entirety simply doesn't apply in the context of a homeowners association given the mandate in 31021D.
Well, Judge Johnson doesn't seem to be asking for more information from this court. She seems to have ruled in your favor at this point.
Well, I understand that, I think there are some legitimate concerns, and I think that they should be addressed. And for example, one of the primary concerns has to do with the issue of comparative negligence.
Are you conceding that we need to send this back to her, then?
Excuse me?
Are you conceding that we need to send this case back to her?
I believe that we
should. And intervene by sending it back?
I believe that the court should intervene and send it back with respect to this particular issue because of the difficulty, and it's expressed by the judge, in applying a Rule 23 analysis to the circumstances of a homeowners association.
Well, let's explore that, Mr. Terry. The difficulty noted in the judge's order was really singular in nature. It dealt solely with the question of numerosity. The judge did not decide this case on numerosity. By implication, the judge appears to have accepted the fact that the statute itself satisfies the numerosity requirement in a Rule 23 analysis. The comment in the restatement dealing with a Rule 23 analysis is focused on what are the causes of action, what are the defects, and what are the defenses, and asking the trial judge to examine those questions and then classify them. If there were limited number of constructional defects based upon extrapolation evidence that affected a smaller number of group, there'd be subclasses for purposes of trial. Why couldn't the judge do that, and why doesn't our existing jurisprudence allow the judge to focus in that manner?
Again, I think the difficulty is in stating that it's a Rule 23 analysis and then asking the trial court to pick and choose among those provisions in Rule 23 that that he or she is going to apply, or which ones are inconsistent with the statute and which ones are not.
Well, the only thing that the statute is really talking about is the numerosity issue. It's simply saying if there are two or more, the association has standing to prosecute the claim. Now the question is, which claims, which defects, and subject to which defenses? There may or may not be a commonality or typicality with respect to some or all. Even Schutte recognized the presence of subclasses. Why can't that analysis be done in this context?
Well, I believe an analysis could be done, although it would be, I think, really different than what we typically think of in a class action where, particularly under the directives of Schutte, you have really one defect that runs throughout the entire class.
Right.
Here, in the context of a homeowners association, you might have one defect that affects five unit owners. You might have another defect that affects two unit owners, or you might have another defect that affects all the unit owners. And could that be done on a defect-by-defect basis? And I think the answer is yes, it could be. And ultimately, it will be done because at trial, the trial judge is going to have to make a determination as to whether or not the judge is going to allow the extrapolation of that defect to other units and to what extent the trial is going to allow extrapolation. So as a practical matter, the trial judge is always going to have to make that determination as to whether or not it can be extrapolated or not.
But if you don't do the Rule 23 analysis before trial and you just wait till you get into trial, how do you deal with claim and issue preclusion down the road for people who want in or out of the class, and what's the scope of that preclusion? I mean, I think what we're saying is that the Rule 23 determination puts it in earlier in the case procedure so people know what's at issue in this suit and what claims are going to trial on behalf of what groups. Because what I really hear you saying is it should just wait until trial, and then we'll sort it all out.
Well, any party is free to make a motion for declaratory relief during the course of the trial and require this to be spelled out. So what I'm suggesting is that in every case, it automatically will be done. I think a defendant would also have the right to raise the claim in the form of a motion for declaratory relief. However, I think the difficulty the judge in this case had was that if you look to Chapter 40 Rule 23 jurisprudence, you have this minimum requirement of at least 40 people when the statute says two is enough. And I think that's where you really put the trial courts in a difficult spot. They take all of Rule 23, they take parts of Rule 23, which parts do they take? And in this case, the trial judge said, I don't know how to do this because I know that the numerosity requirement doesn't work.
May I ask one more question?
I'm going to allow additional time, of course.
The other problem I'm struggling with is the original order from this court on the prior proceeding stated, therefore, in accordance with the analysis in D.R. Horton, we direct the district court to review the claims asserted by High Noon to determine whether the claims conform to class action principles. That's an explicit directive to the district court. And then I compare that to paragraph 35, the last sentence of the district court's order on remand that Justice Hardesty alluded to early on in today's argument, saying that conducting a class action analysis, requiring it to meet all the requirements of Rule 23, on defects affecting the common interest community, such as those upon or within the exterior walls, wall openings, and roofs, would nullify NRS 116.3102. So we're in a position now where clearly the district court did not follow the mandate from the first appeal, correct?
I think the answer to your question is yes, but I think the judge explained that she did not feel that she was capable of doing it because of, at least in part, the numerosity provisions in Rule 23.
But counsel, even though if I accept part of your statement as being true, 116, say, taking out the numerosity requirement, why not, as Justice Hardesty put forth, does not commonality, typicality, and adequacy, why should that not be reviewed?
Okay, well, again, with respect to commonality, I think an analysis could be done. However, we would be looking at, in a typical case, a whole series of subcategories or subclasses, to use the class language, and certainly that could be done. Under the statute, as long as there's two or more people that are affected by the same defect, then 31021D would seem to allow the claim to proceed.
But counsel, as I said, why not the analysis? Why not the court intervening and looking at, opposed to the court saying, we don't have to do this, 116 gets us there, we're done, is basically what she did. Why aren't you required to go into those three points in some detail to see if there's commonality among the units or typicality?
Again, well, I think when you look at typicality and you look at adequacy of representation, which are two of the four elements in Rule 23, that determination has really already been made by the legislature because those two elements really focus on the class representatives. They don't really focus on the claims themselves. The only aspects of Rule 23A, anyway, that focus on the claims are the first two elements, one of which is numerosity and the second of which is commonality. The second two elements focus on the adequacy of the claims representatives to adequately represent the class. And I would submit that the legislature has already made that determination.
But the problem with that, Mr. Terry, is in this particular case, we have an unusual circumstance in which there was 194 assignments by homeowners to the association to proceed with constructional defect claims. And when the trial judge did the 23 analysis with respect to the assignment portion, her conclusion was that commonality, typicality, and predominance could not be satisfied. I struggle with arriving at a conclusion that the same analysis could be done with respect to the association's representative capacity under 116 and satisfy class action requirements. If the judge couldn't find that with respect to 194 homeowners on an assignment theory, how could she arrive at the conclusion in a class action that it could be done?
Well, I think...
In essence, what I'm getting at, it seems like the judge did not have enough information in the record, even with the 194 assignments, to find commonality or typicality among all the constructional defects.
Well, I believe, and I don't want, you know, I want to speak for the trial judge. It appears what the trial judge did was reach the conclusion that she could not do the analysis with respect to the Rule 23 simply because of the numerosity issue, and therefore she read into First Light 2 that the analysis only took place with respect to the interiors of the units.
Well, maybe my question was poorly articulated, Mr. Terry. I was directing your attention to the analysis that the judge did with respect to the assignments. There were 100, she did, in the same order, she did two different analyses. One dealt with 194 assignments. And in that analysis, she rejected a class action proceeding because of the deficiency in her ability to identify any commonality or typicality or predominance with respect to any of the claims among the 194. So I infer from that that the record may have been defective with respect to the evidence that would allow the district court judge to do that.
I believe that there was not enough analysis of the evidence presented to the judge to have reached that conclusion. In that respect, I would agree with Ron.
So I guess if that problem was present in examining the constructional defect claims that the association was making on behalf of the 194 as it means, why isn't that same problem present when the association makes these claims in a representative capacity?
Well, again, I think the same problem exists in that the trial court did not know how to conduct a Rule 23 analysis given the fact that if the court perceived of a conflict between at least one provision in Rule 23, which would be the numerosity, and therefore, in essence, stopped the analysis at that point. I think that further analysis could be done, but I think it needs to be done not in the context of a Rule 23 analysis, but in the context of the guidelines that the legislature has set out. So you would look at, for example, a defect that affected only two owners, that the association would be allowed to bring that claim. Now, a class action plaintiff in a typical class action case would never be allowed to bring that claim because it would not satisfy the numerosity requirements. But in the case of a homeowners association, it's different because the legislature has specifically said it's okay for the association to bring a claim that involves only two units or three units or four units. Then there's a secondary question, which is that are we going to allow extrapolation beyond those units where that particular defect is identified? So I think it's yes. We could ask the trial court to go back and go through each defect in the report and decide whether or not it was common to two or more owners, and if it was, then it could proceed. Then the next question is going to be, well, are we going to allow extrapolation based on that, or are we not going to allow extrapolation based on that?
Has Mr. Terry answered your question, Justice Hardesty?
He's provided me additional food for thought. Thank you, Mr. Terry.
Thank you, Mr. Terry.
Thank you.
Ms. Clerk, would you please give Mr. Carlson a full 5 minutes in rebuttal? Mr. Carlson.
Justice Hardesty, I was able to find the report that you inquired about and wanted to make sure that I hadn't made any errors in my presentation. What we were provided with was a report that starts off with a defect field area general, and then it goes under tile roofs, and it goes A, broken field tiles, B, chipped field tiles, C, slipped or unsecured field tile, D, exposed underlayment, and then it goes on for four more. And then below that was that they had found in this defect in 19 buildings, and then they list several buildings. And then they go on to sub-defect B, chipped field tiles were found in 24 buildings, and then they list which 24 buildings. They're not the same as the first 19. They then go to slipped or unsecured field tiles, which I guess, well, what is different from chipped tiles, and they found that in three buildings. Again, not the same as the previous building.
What?
That's the kind of data that was presented.
Right. What is the record on appeal there reference?
This is part of our this is part of our lodgment, and it is under attachment C. Oops, sorry. Unfortunately, they're not numbered.
Mr. Carlson, could you provide that to the court subsequent to arguments, if you'd like?
Okay. I'll be happy to do that now.
Mr. Carlson, based on what you just read off to us, and what a question that was asked by Justice Hardesty earlier, would that not allow the district court to have subclasses if they had performed a full analysis?
It would allow it. I think she would conclude that it was not a good method by which to conduct the trial because the subclasses would be so numerous as to be almost individualized in nature. If I had continued reading, I would find that in one of the situations they found a defect in no buildings. So we have a defect allegation without any findings. I also invite the court to consider that they didn't inspect all the buildings. So we have buildings that haven't been inspected, and then we have the subclasses. The issue that I think from our side is most important is that we have apparently one entity, one individual who has rights. Those rights are trying to be asserted by one of the individuals, not by the other. Are we protected in that situation? Can we be sued twice? Can we face these same claims because the association has seized these rights to itself and made a claim? And in this case, as we're going to talk about, I guess, eventually, the association has no obligation to repair these homes, has no obligation to do anything on the exterior of these homes. And the only time it has any obligation...
Counsel, that part is not really before us, so
that's true.
That takes us off a different way.
I will stick to this. The final part is, yes, they could do subclasses. I think that the court would find... as Judge Earl did in the Schutte case, that it didn't fit well with this class action because the common proof element, which is the hallmark, I think, of class actions, what makes them viable, doesn't really exist if you have to go through 35 individual units to satisfy one subclass. You haven't saved any judicial time. You haven't saved any of the parties' time.
Well, counsel, contraire, if you're sitting there with 140-some-odd sub-trials, which I had the privilege once to sit through, you are saving time.
What should we tell Judge Johnson if we remand this, if we do remand? What should we tell her?
My initial thoughts were frivolous, but I thought about it in more detail, and I think that the court should indicate that in spite of the judge's misgivings, that first light is the mandatory requirement, and she has to do the analysis. As was pointed out by the Justice Hardesty, I believe she did the analysis for the interior issues, she can do it for the exterior issues. The building envelope is not a particularized area that would allow any different treatment from the rest of the unit, and I think that she needs to go through and do the individualized analysis and make a determination that that these questions predominate and that they are a better vehicle to resolve it in fairness to all parties than just to say, I can't do it, but I think they're entitled to it. So those are my comments.
Mr. Carlson, a similar question with respect to your comment that by proceeding without class certification or some guideline with respect to how the case will proceed,
that you need to be concerned about being sued over and over and over again. Is the same true, or does this court, should this court be concerned about the rights of the individual homeowners whose rights might otherwise, by way of claim preclusion or issue preclusion, be taken up by this type of cause of action and not adequately litigated, but they would then be without recourse?
I do believe that the court has to be concerned about that. I've been chastised by individuals for trying to assert the rights of the homeowners, but I do believe that their rights should be protected in this situation. We don't think that the developers should be subject to two sets of lawsuits. We don't think the homeowners should be deprived of their rights. This case presents an interesting example of that, which I guess we'll address shortly. So, yes, I think the homeowners have to be protected, and the homeowners association, especially one without an obligation to repair, has to, in fact, be looked at very carefully before they assert the rights of others who may or may not want to be in this lawsuit.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson.
Before you sit down, just something that you kind of touched on, but and it struck me as I was going through this term of art that's been thrown out there that doesn't really have a definition, which is building envelope, but yet the statute refers to common interest community. Isn't that the common parts of the structures, what's at issue, opposed to using this other term of envelope?
Well, the common interest community is, again, kind of ill-defined area. The CC&Rs in this case actually define common elements, which is what the homeowner association has the right to repair and obligation to repair. They don't include the building envelopes. They, in fact, include various general areas, such as the streets, the sewer system, the gates, the approach, and landscaping associated with those. So if the common community is those elements defined as common elements, then I would have to say that no, the association doesn't have an interest in the exterior of these buildings. And then, as a practical matter, there may be ramifications to the homeowners as to why the association doesn't have to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. We will move into the next argument, which is 58630. But before I do so, because it is the same parties, I'd like to inquire, do I have any advanced technology students in the courtroom here today? Advanced Technology High School? Very well. The first case this morning, then, will stand submitted.